You're back at the Faculty Factory podcast, and I'm Kim Skorupski here at Hopkins looking at my new friend and colleague, Dr. Ludi Shi. Hi, Ludi.
Hi, Kim. How are you?
I'm so good. Let me tell you who Dr. Shi is. She is lots of letters after her name, and you need to know that she's an MD, MM, SC, FAAN, FANA. I don't even know what most of that is, but there's a lot of letters there. She is an associate professor of neurology. She is the director of Deep Brain Stimulation Program at Boston University School of Medicine, does a lot of work in Parkinson's disease, deep brain stimulation, essential tremor, dystonia. I was looking her up, super famous, and she's got a great, great story to tell you today. I'm not going to steal the thunder, so I'm just going to let Ludi Shi tell you about, tell you her story. You're going to love it. Go ahead, Ludi.
Thanks, Kim. And by the way, I enjoy your podcast so much. It's a real pleasure. I never really thought that I would be a guest on this show. So I'm happy to be here.
Well, see, this is what happens to you, folks. Dr. Shi emailed the Faculty Factory and said, hey, I love your podcast. I love the one on leadership. And I'm like, oh, you liked exploring leadership? You can be on the podcast. And she was like, no. And I'm like, yes. So this is what happens when you email people, right? You're on a podcast, so you too can be on this podcast. So thank you, Ludi, for the courage to email us, for thanking us for the work. It really makes us feel good that we're, you know, people actually appreciate the work. So I can't wait for you to tell your story, though. We've never had a story like this on the almost, I got over 5 years of podcast, so.
Well, great. I'll go back to training because, like maybe a lot of people, I ended up doing my internship in medicine, neurology residency, fellowship in movement disorders all at one place. And I became a faculty member at that place. And this was at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston, part of the Harvard Medical School teaching hospital system. Great, great environment to train in. Loved the program, loved the faculty. I have to say, I do have a connection with Hopkins too, because when I was a fourth year medical student, and you'll see this is a theme and recurring in my story. I love to try places, try new things. And I rotated at Hopkins as a fourth year med student and had an absolutely amazing time at Hopkins. So I probably would have loved to have matched at Hopkins had my husband been able to swing the Baltimore area for jobs. But lo and behold, we were in Boston, and this was the program I wanted to be at. So I ended up doing movement disorders fellowship, ended up developing a great interest in Parkinson's disease, dystonia, tremor, all the things that we are able to actually treat with surgical therapies, which has been just one of the blessings, you know, in neurology, especially, you know, in the 80s and 90s, very nihilistic point of view about therapies for neurologic diseases. So I was immediately drawn to this area as a field. And I had great mentorship, wonderful faculty around who really showed me the ropes. I did not really have anyone in my family in medicine, let alone academic medicine, let alone at a Harvard teaching hospital. So I was really grateful for folks around me, like my mentors, Dan Tarsi and David Simon, to show me the ropes. And I did that for a while. And I think that I was a valued member of the faculty. But, you know, right around year 7 or 8 after being on faculty, started feeling like, gosh, am I doing what I should be doing? And boy, I really love clinical research, but boy, is it hard to also get funding to protect your time to do that. And boy, I love taking patients, but it's hard work too. And I wish I had more help. And also, I'm just curious about all these other areas that are happening. And lo and behold, now we're starting to think about innovation in new medicines and genetic therapies for neurologic diseases. And here I am, I'm sitting across the river from Cambridge, Massachusetts, and the ecosystem here in Boston is just phenomenal for exchange of ideas across public and private sectors. And I just was thinking, what would it be like if I actually went into research and development in a biotech or pharmaceutical company? And so I started exploring this, and I didn't really find one that I liked at first. And I thought, well, let me just see how this grant goes. And, oh, I kind of want to finish this project. And, well, this is a cool idea. I'm going to work with these folks, and this will be enough. But at the end of the day, I asked myself, and I said, will I have regretted not trying this? And I told myself, yeah, I would very much regret it if I closed myself off to another opportunity to learn. Because I think for me, that's what drives a lot of decisions I make. I make decisions often by, you know, of course, the benefit and the impact it might have on other people, but also, am I going to grow from this? And that's what I decided to do. So that's where I went. And I joined a company at first that was well known for creating neurologic therapies. This is a company called Biogen, and a lot of neurologists know them because they've been making medicines for people with multiple sclerosis. But they really had a mission to try to treat neurodegenerative diseases like the ones for the patients I'd been taking care of. And as you know, often when you're taking care of people with chronic serious illnesses, you begin to think, am I really doing anything for these patients? And I started working on programs with other neurologists who had trained just like myself and other scientists who trained in the same, you know, hospitals and labs and universities that we all have been to. And it was actually a really fun environment. I really got time to sit and think and read more than I'd really ever read before about some of the, you know, the biological basis of the diseases of patients that I've been taking care of and treating. And tremendously eye-opening experience. And I had great fun doing it. So I'm an example of someone, like many, I think, because I've been reached out to a lot, physicians who are contemplating, you know, a career in industry. But as I'll tell you more, that story didn't end with me staying in industry. So what happened? So I ended up feeling like I had a lot of contributions to make, but I also felt a little bit like, you know, this is an area that I wonder what it would have been like had I known, you know, what are some of the ways in which we can conduct clinical research in the academic setting that would line up better with the impact, the potential impact on patients, and whether that's new therapies or even better natural history studies or better biomarker studies or even better epidemiologic studies to help us understand how big of a problem really is this and who is the population that needs this medicine and what is their, you know, natural history or progression of the disease. And so I started to think about these a lot in terms of Parkinson's disease. And I realized really in my role as a clinician before, I didn't have sort of access to or a network that would enable me to spend time thinking about these questions. And so I tucked that in the back of my pocket. And I thought, well, you know, I'm still, you know, interested and enjoying working on the programs here. I also say there was a personal aspect to the way the work is constructed in industry that's different in academic medicine. And for someone like me, who really enjoys working in teams, not been one to really, you know, be obsessed about taking singular credit for anything. I've always been on teams that I've been proud to be a part of, even if I wasn't the top dog. I was, you know, I'll go back to my, you know, cross country and track and field days in high school. I was really, really proud to be of a high performing team, but I was nowhere near the best or fastest person. But to be part of it, to be part of the environment where you're contributing to that, that always drove me. And so in industry, you have that. And I just think that there are lessons learned there that we can take, you know, back into academia. So did that for a while. Actually even switched to another company because I thought I was following a person who I thought would be a fantastic mentor. And true to form with the volatility of the industry, she calls me up 3 days before I start and says, you know, I won't be here. I'm leaving the company. So I'm like, oh. That's interesting. So that was another issue that I faced, and I still joined the company, still did what I was brought in to do. This was at Vertex Pharmaceuticals, and they're a very exciting company because they're creating a lot of therapies for strongly genetically defined diseases, which I think are very tractable from a biological standpoint. And they were very interested in a lot of severe, you know, serious neurologic diseases that are highly genetically determined. And so I did that work, and I did a lot of the pre-work for a lot of programs that were about to be coming into the company, and enjoyed that a lot too, because I got to, again, be around really smart physicians, physician scientists, regulatory people, biomarker people, pharmacology people. I just learned so much, but then ultimately decided, you know, I really miss getting to work in the area that actually, looking back, I had actually built up a fair amount of expertise in. I didn't know it at the time. And truthfully, I think when I was leaving academia, that's when all the appreciation came in for everything that I was doing. And I thought, well, maybe now that I know, you know, maybe I can leverage some of the experiences and go back and fashion a career. Whereas because in academic medicine, right, you have the ability, we have this enormous privilege to shape our careers. How many people can say that they have a job like that? And sure, there's constraints. Sure, there's red tape. Sure, there's, you know, the need to do, you know, be someone who's clinically productive or productive on grants and so forth. But, you know, within those constraints, right, we have a fair amount of say of what we get to work on. And that's very unique. And so that's really sort of how I ended up back in academic medicine.
Wow. Ludi, thank you so much for sharing this story. And I have a ton of questions. Is it okay?
Sure.
Can we go back to when you started at year 7-8 faculty member? You know, you told us you had great mentors. And hey, shout out to Dan Tarsi and David Simon. If you're out there, let's get you on and talk about how you mentor people, because Dr. Ludi Shi is endorsing your mentorship. So you had these great mentors. You're at year 7-8 saying, am I doing what I should be doing? I'm curious about other things. You're obviously a learner. You love to explore. So it's like year 7-8, and then you go to Biogen. Can you take us back to that time when you started, you know, inquiring, thinking about maybe coming up with an action plan? How did that first conversation go with your department chair or whoever you reported to? How did that conversation go with mentors when you said, you know what I'm thinking about? Or did you kind of just drop the bomb? I've decided to. How did you work through the telling people, asking advice from people, and then being kind of maybe being on the other receiving end of people going, oh, you're going to regret it, Ludi. You're academic. How can you do this? How can you go to pharma? You're going to really, you know, regret this is not going to be a good move for you. How can you throw away your whole career? I mean, did those conversations even happen, or were people just like, that's awesome, bye? So can you take us back to that moment, Ludi?
Yeah. You know, I would say, you know, the 7-8 year mark was sort of where I started to think about it. I took a really long time to decide. I didn't actually move until the 10th year, right, after I had started as a faculty member. So, yeah, but, you know, it's interesting. I had a mentor who was just very, you know, would be very open to these conversations, but I didn't really actually bring it up directly with him. I maybe dropped it here or there and said, you know, have you ever thought about this? And, you know, they kind of took the question kind of literally and like, you know, no, I don't know. I never really thought that those would go anywhere. So I never, you know, so it's just sort of that was a very limited conversation. So my conversations had really been around, you know, and with people who had already made the transitions and learning what they did and, you know, could I see myself doing that? And so the latter was true. I just sort of one day said, I'm doing this because I, you know, I took a year and a half to decide, right? It wasn't like I had sort of negotiation with other people within my department. That wasn't really about that. It was really about, I want to know if this is, I'm curious and I really want to know if this is something I would enjoy.
So you were an associate professor at the time?
An assistant professor. Yep.
You were an assistant professor. You'd been appointed as an assistant professor. So you had not gone through a formal promotion process.
No, at HMS, at Harvard Medical School, most everybody's appointed as an instructor. And it often takes a few years to make it to assistant. I was very proud of the fact that I, you know, was promoted to assistant professor after 6 years or so.
Okay. So did you end up taking a leave of absence, or did you literally terminate your position there? How did that work legally?
Yeah, a lot of people can actually, and I did this too, maintain an appointment. And depending, you know, what you end up doing, there should be some kind of teaching activity. So I actually kept my half-day clinic for a little while longer, and then also precepted movement disorders fellows. So I would still be working my full-time job, but you know, every other Friday morning or afternoon, I can't remember which, I would come over and staff patients with the fellows. So I kept my Harvard appointment. I think it probably got changed to a lecturer appointment, but I kept that throughout the duration, actually. Yeah.
And so you didn't have to worry about credentialing or keeping your license up when you went then to Biogen? I mean, was that part of the criterion for being a Harvard appointee that you had to keep up that all certifications and whatnot?
Well, certainly because of the activity I was doing, which was still seeing patients and being responsible for care, for that reason alone, you know, the licensing and credentialing needed to be maintained, as well as malpractice insurance. And so a lot of times departments will say, sure, you could do that. And a lot of departments actually do host people in their clinics who are full-time working in some industry. We even have them in our department currently. And, you know, the malpractice insurance is covered. You don't necessarily generate revenues towards your salary for this part of it. You're really kind of doing it pro bono, except for the malpractice insurance that the department is still covering for you.
Okay. And then a couple of just more logistic questions here. Did the department share with you, or did your colleagues share with you any kind of remorse or dismay that, wow, you're leaving us high and dry, and gosh, how we can have people cover this, and it's not really helping us out, and actually now you're costing us money, and bah, humbug, loony. Was it a lot of the waggling of the fist of the finger, or how can you remember how that experience was on their end?
Yeah, no, certainly. I can only guess. I can only imagine that, yes, it was a hardship for me to do that, but externally, again, working with just very nice people who wanted to be supportive and say, well, you know, we're glad that you want to try something. We're supportive of that. And but of course I knew that it was going to be a challenge to come up with the coverage and the other things that go into trying to fill someone's day. At that point, I'd been running the fellowship program and the deep brain stimulation program and caring for a load of patients and things like that. So there were some things that would have to be taken care of.
So you worked with a lot of people for transitioning and getting succession planning in place, and obviously maintain that involvement and activity. So nothing burned down or blew up then when you left, right?
Right. I don't think so.
that's a good point that I want to underscore, Ludi, is that in your experience, I think a lot of faculty members, we worry and we angst and we lose sleep. But if I do that, oh my gosh, you know, I'm really putting everybody in a bad spot. And what's going to happen to my clinic and my grants and everything on my patients? Oh my gosh. And we go time kind of like worst case scenario. And yes, it's a disruption and it can be handled poorly, but it can also be handled as, you know, well as you can prepare for anything. And there are some things that we can control, but it's possible, it's doable, and you did it, obviously. Can you tell us how now you're at Biogen, and how long were you at Biogen while maintaining that Harvard appointment? Was it the whole time you were at Biogen?
Yeah, so let's see, I was probably there about a year and a half, close to 2 years before I decided to switch companies, and I maintained that, and I actually maintained it through my other company as well, so.
And then how long were you, is it called Vertex?
Yep, Vertex. That was about a year, actually. Yeah.
Okay, so we're talking maybe 3 years where you went to the dark side. So you were at pharma learning. I'm saying that facetiously. You went rogue. You left academic medicine. You're super curious. You learned a lot. Worked on these wonderful, wonderful teams that really, you know, sparked your curiosity even more and filled up your heart with joy, and your brain was all lit up on fire with all this wonderful dynamic relationships and people talking and helping and sharing with each other. I can just imagine the energy, because we're both extroverts, so that gets me all excited thinking about the teams. And then what happened around year three at Vertex when you're like, all right, check, this is been great. I'm so proud of myself. I've learned so much. And now where was the siren song call? Like when did academic medicine start going, Ludi, Rudy, come back, come back. Oh, how did that happen?
Yeah, I think it's probably two sort of concepts were going on in my mind at that time. And one was, even though we have, and I think we're on the verge of creating more therapies, better therapies for pretty serious diseases that haven't really, we've had not much to offer. I think that's incredibly exciting. I'm not sure if they happen to be the diseases that I've been taking care of patients for so long. And I thought, we have other things we can do for these patients too. And who's working on that, you know? And again, the expertise I had built up over the years, and I found myself in a new area of diseases, which were in pediatric neuromuscular diseases. That's very different from Parkinson's disease, although, you know, still very interesting to think about and design from, you know, clinical trials and research and biomarkers point of view. It's doable. I can do those things. It's not actually, if you like logical thinking and creating, you know, experiments and designing studies to answer questions, you can take those skills and transplant them to other disease areas. But that first concept was really around, you know, I can also do other things for these patients, right? And at the end of the day too, and lo and behold, and we'll get to this, but like, I didn't know that COVID was going to happen. And look at how much COVID has changed healthcare. And I feel even more strongly now than I did before. We are becoming more rare, you know, physicians who actually care for patients and can provide that overall big picture view of what they need. Maybe a drug may not be a drug. In fact, much of the time it's not. What we do for patients sometimes is hard to define, sometimes hard to measure in this era of WRVUs. And so that was concept number one, is I actually have more, I have more to give back. I'm not done. Concept number two is a little bit along those lines. I started thinking, you know, I'm mid-career. I'm thinking ahead. What do I want to have done at the end of my life? And I'm already thinking about legacy planning and succession planning and some of the things in retrospect I really enjoyed and didn't really understand what a privilege it was until, you know, my old residents and fellows were reaching out to me like, well, who are we going to send our patients to? Who are we going to ask a question? And I realized, oh my goodness, training and always training the next generation of physicians is such important work. Mm-hmm. And that's when I said, I can do that a little bit here in industry because there's some, you know, physicians always coming in, but boy, you know, that's why we work in academic medical centers, right?
Impact on the patient. I love that. I love the journey of your brain and your heart. Like you just following that and then having the courage to go out and then the courage to go back. And I just think that is such a beautiful, freeing, flexible way to live a life of just being curious and going where that leads you without, the courage, without being so burdened by the what if, what if, what if. At some point, just go, yeah, what if? And then I'll, and then we'll deal with the what if.
Yeah. Yeah. I was just going to add, I mean, there is something to that. Once you make that first move, you realize it's not the end of the world. I actually can move. I mean, there's definitely something, you know, you don't want to move too often. I think sometimes people will look at me like, oh my goodness, there's been so many moves in the last few years, but they were all I had very specific hypotheses. I even made my career moves.
Yeah.
Scientific experiments. I'm going to answer this question because I realized this variable wasn't maybe quite right. And I'm going to test this. And if this doesn't work, I know this is what I think now, you know, these days, especially again, COVID changed everything. You're seeing a lot of movement. A lot of people are now rethinking those priorities and rethinking, well, gosh, you know, what value do I bring? And what else could I do? What other odysseys or journeys could I envision for myself out there? And we have so much value to bring, sometimes more than we know.
Well, Ludi, so take me back then to Vertex when you're like, you know what, boss, I think I'm going to go back to academic medicine. Where they're like, no, don't. You're such a great team player. You're such a great R&D person. How can you? Was that going on there as well?
Oh yeah, for sure, for sure. Yeah, you know, one doesn't really know, you know, how one is perceived, but I think in both places I was perceived as a very valuable person, and I was given a lot of plum assignments. I, even at Biogen, I, you know, basically pretty quickly was realized that this person is our in-house expert on this. Let's get her to present. And I actually soon found myself in front of the board of directors presenting to a fairly, you know, well-established mid-cap biotech company board of directors. Is no small chump change. I also found myself in the middle of the desert. I was traveling with my family over the shutdown Christmas holidays because I had to join a call because, boy, we're doing diligence on a high priority asset for the company. And I have to be on that call. So I'm here calling in the middle of the desert. And these are the kinds of things. And I was sent to a lot of assignments. I went to the UK and I went to Portugal to talk to regulatory agencies about our programs. And this is all within the first year and a half of being in pharma. And I'm incredibly, incredibly grateful. And I felt bad that, you know, I think that they did feel that there was a future for me there. But, and I think this has been also a recurring theme in my life is that, you know, I'm getting some feedback that I'm good at this, but is it really what I want to do?
And kudos to you. Again, I just keep thinking courage, 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 to not be influenced by the fears about what people will think of me. Oh, are people going to think I'm a failure? I couldn't hack it in academic medicine. And then, oh, people now feel that I couldn't hack pharma. I couldn't hack industry. I don't have the chops to be in business. I'm going to go running back to academia. So you have your, like you said, you had your scientific hypotheses. And once you've collected your data, done the experiments, come up with a conclusion, and next steps, you really had the just kind of charting your own path. And now I can't help but ask what some people are probably thinking. When you left Vertex, first, I want to know, okay, so secondly, I want to know how you found yourself back at Boston University and how was that process getting, convincing them that I'm not a pharma person, only I, you know, how did you, was that a sell, a tough sell? That's number two. Number one, did you have to move from a home into a canvas pop-up tent now that you've gone back to academic medicine and probably don't make as much money? Were you making a lot more money in pharma?
So I'll answer that last question first, because I think, you know, since I've become known a little bit in my circle for my journey, I've been, hey, could I talk to you, you know, discreetly about something I've been thinking about? And you've been seeing a lot actually in the pandemic. And so I would say the monetary rewards are greater, but not by a whole lot. For me, that wasn't a huge deal, although there is something about feeling like the monetary, you know, amount, you know, you feel appreciated. I think there is something to that effect. And so, but I kept my same lifestyle, still driving my Honda Civic, you know, like, you know, I did not use it. For me, it wasn't the means to, you know, we were pretty established, you know, a home and two kids, lucky to live in a nice, you know, family neighborhood. And that part was fine. That part just did not change, you know, by going to industry and nor coming back.
And you didn't double or triple your salary. It was not double, triple.
No. Okay. And maybe, to be honest, being in Boston, we don't, general physician salaries are not as high in Boston as in other parts of the country. And so maybe, you know, the biotech and pharma companies realize what actually is the current salary most people are making here. So, but coming back, I was, you know, and this mileage is going to vary by person. I was someone that had spent 10 years in academia. I had friends at all the teaching hospitals, at the Brigham and Women's, at the Mass General, at the BI, you know, and then Boston. I also had contacts there. And it actually did become, you know, people had been telling me, oh, don't worry, you'll have options when you go back. And I said, I don't know. Is that true? Is that really true? It turned out it was, actually. I did have a few different places I could go back to. And it was ultimately sort of a decision about, well, should I go back to my old institution? Should I land over at the Brigham, where I was precepting fellows also? Or should I land you know, Boston University. Well, that's kind of an interesting population. That's new. That's different. And in this case, I went with, again, I told you this, you know, what's usually subconscious, but, you know, I think when I look back, looks like a lot of the reasons why I make sometimes the decisions I do, for better or for worse, is, am I going to learn something new? Am I going to, you know, and this is a different patient population. This one's more closely attached to a university, Harvard Medical School, and the three teaching hospitals really function fairly independently. And I thought, well, this looks interesting. I might be able to do more school-wide things, you know, especially with this idea of, you know, loving the idea of being available as a peer mentor or a mid-career mentor to other people who, you know, are early in their academic career path. And so, and having a little protected time and having some resources or staff infrastructure in place to be able to support that was important to me. So that's how I ended up at Boston University.
Wow. And now, how long have you been back in academic medicine?
That's been 3 years and 8 months.
3 years. And you got promoted to associate professor.
Yes.
While in that 3.5. So that obviously didn't hamper your academic progress leaving. And can you tell us, because the team mentality, the team ecosystem was so apparent to you at Biogen and Vertex, how did you bring that mindset, that socialization awareness, at least, back into Boston University? Like, how did that play out for you, where you're like, geez, I wish we could, or back when I was at Biogen, or you know how they do it in Vertex? Or did you notice a difference in the way work was done at Boston when you went back? Was it apparent to you, or did you kind of seamlessly slide in and into the old way of doing things? Or did you miss? I'm trying to get the whole team thing, because team is very important to you. So how did that play out at Boston?
This thing happened right as I had quit my job and was about to onboard, and this thing called COVID happened, you know, March 13th, 2020. My start date was April 1st, 2020. Boy, you know, that we changed everything about how we do things. It took me a little while to figure out who was who. I mean, every time you join a place, it just, and this is another lesson I learned, you know, I had at Beth Israel Deaconess and Harvard Medical School, you know, 15 years of know-how, who's who, where's what phone number is this? I knew everything by heart. Boy, when you join a new institution, you just lack that context. The stuff that people know and understand and assume about that person or this person, you just don't have it, you know? And that just took a while to figure out, you know. And the answer about teams is, I realize some groups are more aligned in the way they work to what I was thinking about, you know, and what I'd been used to now, than others. And I think that became a real important point, because you ultimately in academia, we do collaborate a lot. We do actually work in teams a lot. But I think we, unlike an industry where you're assigned teams, this is your project team, you are the person to work on this one and that one, everyone's role is clearly defined. Everyone knows that they have to meet a common goal. In academia, it's a little bit messy, but it's messy by design, because we allow people to pursue what they're interested in and what they can get funding for and so forth. But even so I think that teams that I here have found had a lot of fun working with ended up being, you know, BU is the home of a very long-running NIH-funded study called the Framingham Heart Study. Okay. And it's a big, complex organization. It's been accruing data for over 75 years. And I'm just so amazed at the participants who have volunteered their time. These are generations and family member upon family member who volunteer to come back and have themselves be assessed so that they can provide insights into what was originally, how do we prevent cardiovascular disease and death? And now it's become, boy, how do we prevent or ameliorate brain aging, dementia, stroke, Parkinson's? And that's just been a really fun team to work with. And I think that I am lucky, you know, in that this ended up being a team that I could work with. And, and we introduce new ideas and different people of different skill sets. A lot of people are not clinicians, and I think that they also have a big role to play in research and in academic medical centers. And we all represent, you know, different members of a cross-functional team, much like an industry. So that has been a real highlight.
Oh, I love it. I love it. I can just see you bringing that sensibility and maybe some of that structure to, you know, your new job is like we all do. The idea of this works. I have a good model. This seems to work well. How can I implement some of that functionality? How can I infuse some of this culture, this excitement around R&D? How can I mimic that leadership model? So that's kind of the beauty of exposing ourselves to different experiences and different industries and different people and different mindsets and diverse opinions and diverse people, because that kind of sparks curiosity and we can bring it back and I'll try that. I mean, everything from, I'm thinking just when friends tell us about little hints and hacks that they do, you go, oh, who knew that was a thing? And now it's improved my life because of this app or this tool or this gadget or this whatever. The same sensibility of, you know, at a more macro level, can we glean from other fill in the blank teams, divisions, departments, institutions, schools, industries, countries, cultures, processes that will, you know, spark more ideas. That's what I think our brains are all about: science and discovery and excitement and failures and questions being answered and directions being rerouted. It's so fun. I love it. I love your story, Ludi.
Well, thank you. I have to add, though, you know, one thing about coming into a new place, especially one that's been there for a long time, doing things the way they're doing, you have to be real respectful of that. And if it isn't close to what you have in mind, you're not going to come in and change things substantially. So I think all that is to say that thankfully, a lot of those processes and this mindset was already there in existence. And I was just very happy to see that. But it is true that coming back, I do find that a lot of other folks who don't have the opportunity to work in such a complex project like this don't actually yet know, oh, what does it actually mean to prepare for a meeting? Why should we have an agenda? Why should we use Microsoft Outlook to schedule these things and circulate something beforehand so that there's a little pre-read or pre-work beforehand? That's something that, you know, is a must in industry, because it's just a way to get stuff done. So I've taken that and created a little, you know, webinar that I just gave to the BU School of Medicine faculty in our professional development group, you know, how to make meetings work for you. Because I do think there's a way to use them where you're not feeling like, man, this just could have been an email or so-and-so is just talking the whole time, all the time. I can never get a word in edgewise. You know, These are the things that, you know, affect all of us, no matter what specialty or discipline you're in.
Well, Dr. Ludi Shi, you just put your foot in it, because now you're going to have to come back to the Faculty Factory podcast and do an episode on how to make meetings work for you, right? Yeah, I hear everybody in the background going, yes, Ludi, come back. That's a really great insight. And thank you for underscoring the importance of understanding culture, which is a blueprint for living. How do we do things around here that you don't want to be the hammer and be the person coming back, go, let me tell you how we did it back at Biogen or back in the day when I was your age. This is how, and people go, oh, crying out loud, how obnoxious. So that emotional intelligence to kind of step back a beat, take a minute to learn the culture, learn where the coffee shop is, where is the restroom before you start telling people how you're going to do your business. Let me tell you how you're going to do things from now on. No, that probably won't go real well. So thanks for underscoring that. You know, this has been such a great story. I love that you're sharing something new. I'm so grateful that you are just coming and being honest about the story, because we all know faculty members who are noodling around these kinds of options, but maybe don't know how to do it, don't feel confident that it is an opportunity or it's an option, and they're afraid or concerned that it may be closing a door. I mean, slamming it shut. If you leave here, don't ever come back. Don't let the door hit you all the way out, kind of a mentality. Well, that's not it. And I coach faculty saying, no one's going to strip your degrees from you. You're not going to, no one's going to, you know, incinerate your CV. You still have earned all of the things you've earned. So it's, what do you have to lose? Like I always play like worst case scenario. What is the worst case scenario? And it's oftentimes, as you pointed out earlier, Ludi, like when people leave for vacation and they're like, oh, I couldn't possibly not check my emails. I couldn't possibly not work. And if you try it, you're on vacation, you don't check your emails or you don't do work. Did you come back? And were your worst fears realized? Had you been fired and you didn't know about it? Did the whole place, you know, burn down? Did all your patients leave you? Did NIH pull your funding? Well, no. Okay, so that's the kind of exhale. Well, I like to check my emails because when I come back, then I don't have 500 emails. Okay, understandable. But you just spent 20 minutes doing that, right? Well, okay. So the idea of, I like how you have kind of blown open some of the fears and maybe allayed some people's concerns that, hey, this might be an option for me. Now, of course, leaders listening to this were like, totally want to delete this episode. Don't tell our faculty to leave. However, this is part of growth and development. And if it proves the experience for patients and for the institution and people are going on a sabbatical, if you will, to learn and they're bringing that wisdom back. Yes. My gosh, you know, what an investment. I think it's wonderful.
Yeah. And I think there's lessons there too. We have so many talented people in these schools of medicine and teaching hospitals. And, you know, we're starting to see, and I have to say a shout out to Amelia Benjamin and Alyssa DeNicola at Boston University, I should say Chobanian and Avedisian School of Medicine, for putting together the mid-career faculty leadership program, which I've been lucky to be part of this year because they recognized, yeah, this is kind of the 10-year mark. If you look at AAMC data, historical trends for attrition by the 10 years, 40% rock steady, no matter what decade. So there is this notion that like we need to renew ourselves, you know, at some point and say, what am I doing? What's in the next few years for me? How do I get there? How do I, as they might say, design my life around you know, what's meaningful to me and how can a place like this support me in doing that? And so I've been so grateful. I mean, I think a program like that could have been useful maybe, but at the same time, like I said, you know, I really had this intellectual curiosity that I didn't think I could really solve differently. So just a quick shout out to them and thank them for all their hard work for the faculty.
You're so kind. And I definitely want to make sure that we think about these sabbaticals. I know in academic medicine, we're not really good at taking sabbaticals, but this is an opportunity to maybe dip your toe into an experience by designing a sabbatical for a period of time to allow us to explore some of these questions and to learn more to help for what we can bring back to our home. So I think this is just wonderful. Dr. Ludi Shi, I love this story. Thank you so much for coming on and sharing it. And I'm sure so many people are so excited by listening to this and going to have lots of opportunities opening up thanks to you. I'm going to let you say the parting words. I promise I'm not going to say anything more other than thank you. Go ahead, Ludi.
Well, no, just thank you for the forum that you also put. I find that at every stage of our careers, we want to share experiences with each other. And I think in this day and age, we're all longing for, you know, making those human connections stronger. And we work in a very interesting and challenging area, but that's so filled with opportunities. So podcasts like this and getting the chance to connect is a great way to give back to the community. So thank you.
Hey everyone, it's your podcast producer, Casey. Just wanted to let you know that as of March 1st, 2024, this podcast has had nearly 89,000 total downloads and YouTube views from listeners in 95 different countries. The website, facultyfactory.org, has drawn over 41,000 web visits from users in 122 different countries. I tell you all of this just to underscore the point that this truly is an international platform, and we want to invite you, no matter where you are in the world, to be a guest on our show. Our host, Dr. Skorupski, makes the experience very engaging, relaxing, and fun. As producer, I'll make any of the edits that you might need on the back end before we publish it. We want to hear from different faculty around the world and learn from each other, so please reach out if you'd like to be a guest or to nominate someone in our academic medicine community to be a guest. You can visit the Contact Us page on facultyfactory.org to send us a message, or contact Dr. Skorupski directly at kskorupski@jhmi.edu.
Thanks for tuning in to Faculty Factory Podcast. The mission of the Faculty Factory is to build and support a community of leaders in faculty development who share tools, resources, wisdom, and encouragement in service to our faculty members, schools, and institutions. We encourage you to go to facultyfactory.org to find out more. Get in touch with me. Ask me any questions. Maybe you want to be interviewed on the podcast. Thanks for tuning in to Faculty Factory Podcast. We'll see you next time.
The Faculty Factory podcast and website is sponsored by the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine Office of Faculty. For more information, visit facultyfactory.org.